You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 89. For July 20th, 2016. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's show, we talk to Army Corps archaeologist Joe Griffin about his recent experience excavating for servicemen missing in action in Laos. So go check out the show notes because this could be right up your alley and because the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. Welcome to the show, everyone. Joining me today are Sonia from Utah.
Hello.
Steven in Calgary.
Hi.
And Doug in Scotland.
Hello.
And Sonia may come in and out of the conversation as her internet decides to work and not work. So, Sonia, it's good to have you for the time being.
Yeah, thanks. I'll stick with you as long as I can.
No problem. All right. So today's show is not strictly CRM archaeology. However, I did see this article from a friend of mine that I worked with in the past who is a CRM archaeologist, but he works for the Army Corps of Engineers in Sacramento. And his name is Joe Griffin, and we're going to talk about his recent work in Laos with a very interesting project. So, Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, first off, let's just hear a little bit about yourself. How long have you been working for the Army Corps, and what did you do before that?
Okay. So I was, when I finished my undergrad, I shovel bummed for several years, went to grad school in Sacramento. And while I was there, started working at the Army Corps where I've been for the last 7 years. So I'm a senior archaeologist with the Army Corps of Engineers, Sacramento District.
Nice. Yeah. So anybody knows the Vernal Utah project. I think we both worked on that, didn't we?
Yeah. Back in Utah.
Were you
working in Alton too, the little excavation out there?
Yes, I was.
You were. Indeed. We got to drive the four wheelers. That was the high point.
That was a good. Yeah. Well, and having a cook for that project, that was pretty awesome too.
Yes, it was. I still remember the breakfast where he poached eggs in this like green salsa. It was life changing.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing for a CRM project. So, yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about your recent expedition, though. You went over to Laos. Tell us about the organization that helped get you there and what you did over there.
Yeah, okay. So there's a federal agency. It's a joint Department of Defense agency. It's based out of Hickam Airfield in Hawaii called DPAA, which stands for the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency. It may be more familiar to any of the physical anthropologists who are listening in as JPAC, which is the previous iteration of the agency. They have an immensely sophisticated lab on the base at Hickam, and they run missions all over the world for the recovery of missing U.S. servicemen from conflicts, mostly ranging from World War II, Korea, and the Vietnam War. There are no more MIA personnel from the Persian Gulf, the first Gulf Wars, so that's it's limited to those earlier wars.
Okay.
What they do is the agency runs investigations that start with the background information surrounding the loss of the individual, which is then built upon by field visits from investigators who talk to local people who might have. So, for instance, if you have a plane crash, you might send investigators into the village, talk to the old guys who may remember the plane going down, right? Or they may remember the POW camp nearby and where some of the people may have been buried. Then when you have a possible location where there might be a service member that can be potentially correlated to a loss incident, then they will send in a reconnaissance team to basically record the site in archaeological parlance, go get an idea of what it looks like, make a sketch map, take some pictures, make a couple notes about what's there, and then they jump right into a recovery. And with the recoveries are they're basically large-scale, really intensive excavations where they excavate 100% of the incident scene. So if there's a plane crash, I refer to plane crashes a lot because most of these incidents are plane crashes, especially in Laos. And that's what mine was. The site will have wreckage.
That could be a big area too.
It can be, yeah, especially when it's a jet. You know, jets don't move slowly.
No.
Or I guess some of the fancy ones do, or they're able to. But anyway.
Right. Not typically in a combat situation.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So they excavate the entirety of the area. So that's the organization and the general structure. Once the once remains are found, remains or any other kind of evidence that might reflect the presence of the service member. For instance, life support material, which is what they call life support, anything that's physically attached to the individual. So if this is an airplane, it's essentially every part of the ejection seat, the flight suit, oxygen system, helmet. Then they also look for personal effects, watch, money, things like that, sunglasses, glasses. All that stuff gets brought back to the lab. And once all the recovery missions are complete, they have the forensic anthropologists look at any remains that may have come back. They have the basically material culture experts look at the any material evidence that may have come back, and they piece together the story that way. And if they can positively identify the remains of a service member, they contact the family and repatriate the remains.
What is the historical? I don't know how much you know about the past expeditions that this project has gone on, but what is the historical accuracy of the information on location? Like, how often do you guys actually find evidence of the missing individual?
That's a tough one to answer. I don't know exactly, but they're surprisingly good. So for most, when airplanes go down, there's always a record of it. The accuracy of exactly where it is can vary a lot. In places where a lot of airplanes went down, it can get confusing as to, you know, which incident is related to which crash site. But they have had relatively good success given the almost needle in a haystack nature of what you're looking for. I think they're given quotas, and I think they recover probably it's in the hundreds of individuals every year.
Wow.
Now those aren't, I should say, identify. That's not necessarily all from overseas missions. Some of those are unidentified soldiers who are identified with DNA. They've had a program where remains are repatriated unilaterally from North Korea, from the Korean War. So they often get, you know, lots of remains that way, which they're then able to identify.
Real quick on the DNA. Yeah. How do they identify via DNA from somebody from Vietnam or Korean War? Do they have like past blood samples or something like that?
Good question. What they use is they use mitochondrial DNA,
which,
as you know, is passed through the matriline. So anyone who is a matrilineal relative of the missing person will be a match. Now, so will, you know, thousands of other people, which is why it's important that they're able to use the mitochondrial DNA because of the nature of the investigation, where they can limit the number of possible people it could be.
Have you ever found any decedent on site that was not the missing individual?
I haven't personally. I think it does occur. And when that happens, that happens often, I think, with situations where you might have like a prisoner of war camp, where you could have prisoners of war from different countries. And when that happens, JPAC in the past and DPAA now would send those remains back to the country of origin of the individual whose bones they do have, if they're able to work that out. But their priority is always the Americans.
Of course. So at what point do you stop when you've actually got firm identification that the American was recovered?
You either stop when you stop when you've completely run out of the potential to find more. So if you can imagine, they do the typical excavation that's conducted is kind of an ever-expanding block excavation. And as you're digging, you note whether you're encountering potential material evidence, life support material, or possible bone or osseous material. And when you get to a point where you stop finding that kind of thing, you stop digging. But so that usually means they excavate the entire incident. They don't actually start doing – well, typically they don't do the forensic analyses until they have finished all the excavations, because it's more cost effective to analyze everything at once rather than analyzing it as it comes in out of the field. The missions are usually only 30 days to 45 days in the field. So they don't generally cover the entirety of the site in that period of time. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. Thank you.
You know, you mentioned, Joe, starting from a point and having the ever expanding block excavation. How do you? I know you guys have information that says, okay, let's go dig here. But when you actually get to the site, do you start with some sort of testing, like shovel testing or test units or trenching or something like that, or you just open up a unit where somebody decided this is where you should open up a unit and start expanding from there?
It's situationally dependent. There are some situations where they will do a form of limited testing, but often they basically jump right into recovery. The site where I was working, I think mine was the fourth recovery mission to go to that site. So quite a bit of the site had already been excavated. Now, when I got there, I actually did a small program of test units to explore another area that seemed likely where there might be more material. And I actually did find stuff on that during that exercise and opened up, you know, another set of units that were discontiguous from the main block. But generally, they just expand out. It's a real, kind of a blunt force approach to excavation, because they're not sampling at all. They're going for 100%.
Okay. And yeah, that brings up another question that was related somewhat to what Sonia was asking. I was wondering, if you're going for 100%, it seems likely that you might find other historic artifacts from the local area and prehistoric artifacts. What do you guys do with coordination with local government regarding those sorts of finds?
Effectively nothing. So that does happen. It's very rare. Well, I shouldn't say it's rare. The prehistoric side is less common, because you're probably more likely to, if you're conducting like a historical archaeological excavation somewhere, you're more likely to encounter prehistoric material there, because you're probably in a location where you have environmental variables that are good for living, right? You might be near a water source or something like that.
Yeah, good
But
point.
If you're in a location where an airplane crashed, it's pretty random. So it's infrequent. Obviously, the people conducting excavations are archaeologists, and so they're interested in that kind of thing. And generally, they will record in whatever detail they can the find, but it's not collected, and it's not usually brought back to the lab. From the stories I've heard in Europe, when they're working in Europe looking for World War II remains, it's a little more common. And in that sort of situation, if you're a reasonable archaeologist, you can get the idea that if you're looking for the remains of someone who died in the 40s and you come across an Iron Age feature, you're probably deeper than you need to be to find the missing service member.
Right.
And you can just stop. In terms of historic artifacts, especially in Laos and Vietnam, where these were intense war zones, there's humongous amounts of material from the war that may not be related to your event. In the case of my site, there wasn't much in the way of evidence of ground battles specifically where I was, but one of my colleagues whose site I went to visit was a helicopter crash that was near a CIA landing zone that had been the spot of intensive fighting. And so there was munitions and clothing and gear and stuff all over the place, which made it a little bit more difficult to narrow down, you know, what's related to the crash and what's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's mostly, if you're thinking about it in terms of like component separation, like you would doing normal archaeology, you have more than one component that you're looking for. Makes the archaeology pretty simple when the only component is a plane crash. It's very distinctive, and it's easy to keep it separate.
So what do you use as your stopping point for units? You know, we often go two sterile levels or something. You know, is it really just, okay, I'm just actually too deep to actually find anything?
A metal detector.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Planes are made of metal. So basically, what you do is you get an idea of how deep the incident is. You can get an idea if there's topographic variability. You can have, you know, you can have a bit of soil deposition that's occurred since, you know, say the 60s, and so the depths are going to vary a little bit across the site, but not dramatically, and they're usually relatively shallow. So you kind of get it. You get a sense for how deep the material tends to be, and then at the end of every unit, you sweep it with a metal detector. The teams all have an EOD technician. My site actually had three EOD technicians, and they have to sweep all the units before you go into them to make sure that you're not going to be hitting unexploded ordnance with your shovels, for instance.
Right.
But then they can also use those same metal detectors to sweep the bottom of the unit to determine whether you are at the base of the incident.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It can get tricky, actually. The newest model of metal detector used by the military picks up carbon.
Oh my!
Because it's intended to pick up, I guess, like some sort of a fuse used in Afghanistan made with batteries or something like that. I don't know the details. But if you have a site where there's been years and years and years of burning, which you do throughout Laos because Sweden agriculture has been the thing for years there,
mm-hmm.
you can get false positives all the way down through your sterile layers. But in most cases, the metal detector does what you need it to do.
Okay. Yeah, I had experience with the explosive ordnance last fall working at China Lake Naval Weapons Center. Yeah, and one thing I was going to ask you about the metal detector and stuff, they didn't actually do any of that. We were out doing survey, so we weren't actually excavating. So they were just kind of walking along in front of us, and we would point mm-hmm. out anything that looked crazy. But, you know, back in that time frame that you're working in, I don't know if this is a concern, but for us, since there's a lot of experimental stuff that happens on China Lake, you know, you're not allowed to have radios or anything that actually transmits or anything like that, too, because that could actually set off mm-hmm. ordnance. I don't know if they talked to you about that stuff over there in Laos for that time frame.
No, that wasn't a risk for what we were finding. We did have radios to communicate, which is good because the site was very large. It was, if I remember right, something like 170 meters long. So it's a little longer than you could just conveniently shout.
Right. Yeah, and you're digging that whole thing up. That's a lot of volume.
Yeah. So we excavated. They like to measure the volume of they don't estimate volume of soil, they record area of soil, and we moved more than 1,000 square meters in 30 days.
Jeez, wow.
It's a huge amount. So the teams work really fast. You know, one of the advantages to not having to worry about component separation is there's no reason to dig in levels because you have the incident and you have not the incident.
So you
dig all the way down to the bottom of the unit. You open 4-meter by 4-meter units. And you have a crew of enlisted guys just moving dirt.
Wow.
Where it's screened and it moves really fast.
Well, we're going to get more into that question because I did have some question about the multidisciplinary management of that sort of thing. But we're going to take a break real quick. And check out this business tip from Christopher Dorr at Heritage Business International and go check out their website. The link is usually in the show notes, and we'll be back in just a few seconds.
Hi, everyone. This is Christopher Dorr with Heritage Business International, and here's this week's Heritage Business tip from the archive. This week, we look at incentivizing performance. Many heritage professionals aren't motivated by money. To incentivize performance, figure out what they really want. A week off to write? A trip to a conference? A chance to take a class or seminar? Work at home flexibility? Bonuses are important, but make them the right kind of bonuses to recognize their contribution, ramp up performance, and build loyalty. To receive our most up-to-date Heritage Business tips, you can subscribe to our free weekly email at heritagebusiness.org. Until next time, this is Christopher Dorr.
Okay, we're back, and we're going to toss it over to Doug. Doug, what's up?
Yeah, Joe, a quick question. What's the recording like when you're doing this sort of work? I take it you're not doing lots of contact sheets and so forth, but how do you normally record stuff like this that's semi-archaeology, semi-not?
So the recording is done following forensic methods more than archaeological methods, which is to say you have a notebook rather than – so I don't have unit forms. I don't have level forms. I don't have any – or context forms, anything like that. I have a notebook, and I had to capture everything in there. Now, typically when you see those crime shows, you know, where someone's a forensics person standing there over the body and like saying stuff into a recorder, writing it down, That's how they want it to be. They want it presented in a narrative format in the notebook, which is, and actually at the end of it all, in addition to the report being peer reviewed, your notebook is peer reviewed. There is strict limitations on what you're allowed to change. You can't cross anything out. You can't go back and change anything, because it's all being treated as though it was evidence. So when you write something down, if you write something down wrong, you have to put a single strike through it so it's still legible, initial it, and then write why you changed what you wrote. So essentially what that comes down to is I'm thinking in terms of normal paperwork, but writing it in a notebook. Now, in terms of components, as I mentioned, there is just the one. So the context is less important than it might be somewhere where you want to get an idea about different, say, activity areas or different occupations or something like that. So what I'm typically recording is, for each unit, the depth of the unit, of course, the location of the unit, and generally what came out of it, in terms of material evidence, life support, and possible osseous material. So the notes are relatively limited, which is somewhat necessary because I'm also the only person out there taking notes. The team is comprised of one military officer, a number of non-commissioned officers, which is to say senior enlisted guys, and me. I'm the only archaeologist out there. At any given time, I'm running between 2 and 4 4x4 meter units, which are moving really fast. So I'm literally running around the site, taking notes, getting out the total station, laying out more units. So it's, you know, the note taking was limited to the general characteristics of the excavation units, characteristics of the site, use of the site, modern use of the site, et cetera, vegetation, depositional regime, this kind of thing. And of course, my survey notes.
When you're doing all that recording And your final report, do you mainly just your final report just about what you recovered and if you recovered human remains, or does it go beyond that to discuss maybe the quality of the human remains? Or I'm assuming most people would have died in the crash, but do you do any sort of analysis beyond that to sort of, you know, determine cause of death? Or anything like that, or is it just simply getting back human remains?
So all the analysis of the remains is done at the lab. Their lab is a certified forensics laboratory So they have very exacting standards and qualifications that they require for all the analysis that they do. And none of it is allowed to occur in the field. You also have to have the, in addition to any education requirements, they have certification tests that the physical anthropologists have to take before they're allowed to conduct any kind of analyses of the bones themselves. In the field, we're not even allowed to determine whether or not they're human. So that means that that does mean that occasionally you're bringing back, you know, chicken bones that you know are chicken bones, but you have to bring it back to the lab because of their certification. They have to have a certified person make that call. So in the field, there's no physical anthropological analysis conducted at all. Now, there's a little bit of, I can look at site formation processes to get an idea, you know, to the extent that it furthers my work towards answering the question, which is the aviator here and where is he? You know, so any kind of work I want to do in the field that gets me closer to that question, I can do.
Okay.
But no analysis that remains.
I have a question real quick on the lab. When you say the lab, you mean something back here in the United States, or are there labs all over the place?
There's one lab. It's at Hickam Airfield on Hawaii.
Oh, okay. So they just take everything back there.
Yeah. And it is mind-blowing.
I can imagine. What about, to get into the lab real quick, this just made me think of another question. What about curation and repatriation of artifacts? I mean, I'm sure some stuff will go back to the families. Some stuff stays with the military and gets curated in some way. And then, you know, I think you mentioned that probably nothing goes back to the country of origin if it's not related to the incident. So what about curation?
So that's a good question. I don't know the entirety of the answer.
Well, it's the military.
When remains, when remains are positively identified, all the remains and personal items go to the family. The life support equipment or anything is determined not to be. I'm not sure if they keep it or not. There's a lot of stuff that we'll bring back because we have another one of the roles on the team is I have a guy who he's called the life support investigator, and he's typically either someone who specializes in life support investigation or more commonly a guy who packs parachutes for the Navy and knows about ejection seats. And so this guy will be out there and he'll be looking at the material that comes out of the units and he'll be picking out stuff that looks like it might be part of the ejection seat or this might have been part of the flight suit. We bring all that stuff back. And if in the laboratory, if they determine that some of this stuff is not actually life support, they just toss it. And the majority of the vast majority of what we find in the units is aircraft wreckage, which of course everything is an acronym, right? The aircraft wreckage is either called ACW or ACS, depending on whose acronym you're using. And all of that is discarded on site.
Okay.
So very little curated.
Okay. Go ahead, Doug.
So why is it the life support stuff is taken back and examined, whereas the other stuff is disregarded?
Because the life support is attached to the person. And the goal of the excavation is only the person. So if you can imagine an ejection seat in an aircraft, if you eject out of the aircraft, you take that seat with you. All of it pops out, right? So if you have a crash and there's no ejection seat or no ejection seat components, it's possible that the aviator ejected. If you have a crash and you have ejection seat components, that means he didn't. So that's evidence that suggests the individual's there.
Okay. Well, I've got a question related to some of the other people you had working with you there. So this is a DOD project, and you said you had you know, other people working that are servicemen and women that are there to help you kind of just excavate in a rapid fashion. So is everyone paid to be there? Are there volunteers that work on this, or you know, where's the funding come from?
Everybody's paid to be there, and the funding comes from you and me.
That's what I figured.
It's taxpayer funded, obviously. Yeah.
Okay.
They're all active duty military.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are we have a workforce of local villagers who are working for us as well.
Okay.
But the bulk of the team is our active duty military guys, and this is this is work for them, and it is work.
Imagine.
We were there 30 days. We worked 28 of the days,
mm-hmm.
and they're working hard physical labor all day.
Yeah. Are the families notified that a team is going out to a location where their ancestor possibly died on site?
Yeah, they are if they ask. So the DPAA will contact the families after they've positively identified someone. But a lot of these families are in active communication with the agency already.
Mm-hmm.
So depends on the family, but a lot of them are very involved, keep up on when the excavations are going out to the different locations, and stay involved in the process, because all the information that we produce it's all government data, and government data is all accessible under the Freedom of Information Act.
Mm-hmm.
They can get any of the information. They can get my site report. They can get my notebook if they want. There have been occasions where family members will volunteer. So I guess there is an occasion where you might have a volunteer. I'm not sure how things work in terms of the expenses of the volunteer, but you will sometimes have a crew member who is related to the missing individual. That wasn't the case on the site where I went to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suppose if you're hiring locals to help out, if somebody wanted to pay their expense to get over there and stay there, that there's no reason they couldn't either get hired almost as a local or volunteer on there in the same fashion.
Well, kind of. I mean, the logistics of it, the site where we're working was at near the top of a mountain.
Hmm.
And so the local workers had set up, they had, hiked up and built themselves a camp up there. We were staying down in the valley below, and we would commute every day in helicopters.
Oh, wow.
And blade hours are really expensive. So they wouldn't put anybody in a helicopter who they didn't need to have in that helicopter.
How many sites do you still have to investigate, or how many incidents? Like, I imagine you guys have gone through quite a few. Could you tell us how many of the project is actually investigated, and how many possible ones there might be in the future, assuming no more wars requiring lots of body recovery?
Well, in modern wars, they have much better means of locating people, and so we tend to have a lot fewer MIAs nowadays, and they're more easily recovered. But in terms of the existing ones, first off, it's not my agency that does it, so I don't have a lot of the full background information on this. But I can say that there are still hundreds of outstanding missing people in Laos, hundreds more in Vietnam, hundreds more in Cambodia, and a few in China, just from the Vietnam War. I'm doing air quotes because obviously it was not just in Vietnam.
Right.
The DPAA website, I don't have it in front of me, but they have good information on how many people are missing, how many are in a status that they consider to be potentially recoverable, which is going to be basically someone who they could potentially send out missions to try and recover. And then a small fraction of those are classified as what they call unrecoverable. And these are cases where they have exhausted every lead. They've probably done at least, they've probably excavated at least one site in its entirety, found nothing, and have determined that they're out of options to find this person, and they're in an unrecoverable state. But there are literally hundreds more who are not in that category.
Sonia, did you have a question that wasn't answered by the previous discussion? Because he kind of got into it a little bit.
He did talk a little bit about it. Most of my question was regarding a statement saying the tech or the equipment that's on site is just discarded on site. And that kind of, as someone who's had security clearance in the past, I wondered about the technology itself. Nowadays, that tech has to be recovered. I mean, there have been incidents where field teams have been or soldiers have been attacked in the field. One of their Humvees becomes disabled and they can't leave. They can't seek cover because they have to protect that technology. So in a situation like this, if, say, I guess the new, I think it's an F-35, if one of those goes down in the middle of the jungle somewhere, do we have to wait until the war is over before the MIA is investigated? That would make sense, but what, would you still abandon that technology on site, or would you recover it and destroy it back in the U.S. or on a designated facility?
I couldn't say. That would be, I mean, if it's in an active war zone, that wouldn't be the kind of thing where DPAA would be involved. And those aren't, I mean, this is Vietnam War era stuff. So there's no concern about that technology. The only potential concern would be with ordnance, and the vast majority of that has already been salvaged.
Okay. So what is the most recent, MIA excavations that are being done? Like, which wars, how recent are they? Do they go back 20 years, 25 years, 40 years?
To the best of my knowledge, the most recent ones that they're working on right now are from the Vietnam War conflict.
Okay.
As I alluded to earlier, all the MIAs from Desert Storm and Desert Shield have been accounted for by now.
Right. Right. And obviously it makes sense that we wouldn't go out hunting for people in Afghanistan or Iraq if those areas are still subject to battle situations. We wouldn't want to send you guys out there for that.
They send people out, but they send very different people.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Of the same guys, but not me.
So basically what you're saying is the equipment is declassified if you're abandoning it on site. If it's not declassified, then you will probably collect it and destroy it on an American base somewhere.
Yeah, I'll put it this way. On my site, there was nothing to worry about in that in that sense. I suspect that if there are situations where that sort of thing would remain an issue, I wouldn't have been told about it.
Okay. That
sounds
probably
good.
Makes sense. Thank you.
Unless that was my site. But most of the covert activities and, I mean, certainly the technology from the mid to late 1960s is not sensitive any longer. And most of the covert activities that were undertaken by the CIA were declassified, I want to say, in the 90s. And so the existence, for instance, of CIA air bases isn't secret anymore. So it's not, we don't have to pretend that didn't happen.
Okay, thanks.
That's a good question.
We've got a few more questions to go, but we're going to take another break real quick, our final one, and we'll come up and wrap this interesting discussion up with Joe Griffin. Back in a second. Women in Archaeology is a show about archaeology by the Women of Archaeology. An alternating panel of women archaeologists discuss the issues in archaeology that impact professionals and the public every day. Check out Women in Archaeology for a different perspective on the past today at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/WIA. Now let's get back to the show. Okay, we're back, and while my software continues to crash, I think I need to do some updates. We'll see if we can get this in. Anyway, Joe, I had a question regarding something you mentioned earlier about your field notebooks and how you said that you can't really erase anything. It's all part of the record, and you have the one line, initial, all that stuff. Well, anybody that's listened to any one of my podcasts knows that I'm a huge proponent of paperless archaeology. So I'm assuming you guys are using notebooks like Write in the Rain type stuff or some sort of special classified military thing that you can write in a swamp. is there any talk? I don't want to go down this rabbit hole too much, but is there any talk about doing this in a paperless fashion? And would that even be possible given the type of evidence you have to, you have to collect? I mean, what the military would have to come up with some sort of special software, because you can always just backspace and they clearly don't want you to do that.
Yeah. So that's a fine question. I mean, the archaeology obviously could be done paperless, just like, you know, it could be done anywhere else paperless, mm-hmm. but the requirements for a forensic laboratory are not set by the laboratory. I'm not actually sure who sets them, but that would be, I would suspect, a slow process to do. Now, I don't think it's beyond the limits of software to make a program where you can't delete. It seems like a pretty,
right,
pretty easy lift for a programmer, but they're at least as far as I know, they're not doing that right now. Yeah, we just used Write in the Rain notebooks.
Okay. Yeah, I could see, you're right, I could see how that could be done. You just have to alter text, but, you know, not alter it, but, you know, single strike through or something like that, and digitally assign, yeah, your initials, like, and things. Yeah.
Like the way track changes works in Microsoft Word.
Exactly.
Turn it off, something like that.
Yeah, that's a good analogy actually right there. Just track changes, yeah, is permanently turned on. Yeah. Track changes with comments. Actually, I think that would actually just work. It's already done. Thanks, Microsoft. So, okay. So another question as we're wrapping up here, what about the, tell us a little more about the multidisciplinary management, because the article we read, and I think you've mentioned this once or twice, you were the only archaeologist out there. How many people did you have, correct, working on this project with the people you guys brought and the locals? Like what was the size of the crew?
So there was me, 18 active duty military guys, and then the number of local workers would vary, but between about 40 and 60.
Okay.
So, and, you know, yeah, at the most 80 people.
Wow, that's phenomenal. And you were the lead person in charge, or was there a military person in charge?
So there, the leadership is structured with kind of three people in charge. So there's me, I'm the recovery leader. I'm in charge of everything that goes on the site. They're not allowed to do anything on site when I'm not there, because I can't keep track of it, because I'm also the only person keeping track of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm directing the excavation completely. In charge of the team is a team leader he's a military officer, and he's in charge of basically everything else, all the logistics, everything that occurs off the site. And in the case of emergency, as came up one day, he's in charge of what goes on the site also. And then kind of below him and me is the team sergeant, who's the senior enlisted guy who works kind of as the crew chief. Now, a lot of the team members, some of them are augmentees who are just on, who are just going out for one rotation, as it were, from their normal units. But a number of them work for DPAA as their primary MOS and are really good. They, you know, this is all they do. They go out and dig, and, you know, they dig as well or better than any field tech you'd come across in terms of, you know, nice, clean, straight walls and flat floors and all that.
Yeah. Well, the military is definitely,
I made one
precise
of them use a trowel once to take a picture.
To take a picture. Nice. Hey, if you know what you're doing, you can do just about as good a work with a shovel as you can a trowel.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. There's some pretty good shovel technicians out there.
Use the coarsest tool possible, right? That's what Jesse Jennings said.
Exactly. You know, this leads into something we were talking about over the break, but you said some of those service members are, you know, this is their MOS, this is what they do, this is their specialty. Mm-hmm. How do the others, do they just like volunteer for this? Is this something the military puts out and says, hey, we've got this kind of thing going on, you know, volunteer for this if you mm-hmm. want to, and then they get a temporary relief from their duties, or do you know how that works?
They volunteer for it, and then their unit sends them.
Okay.
So sometimes it's used as a reward for, you know, for a high performing member of the unit, and sometimes it's used to, you know, get that guy out for a couple of months.
Right.
On my team, I mean, every single one of these guys was absolutely fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So
and for the just on that note, for the for the crew members, I think it had doing this work has a little more meaning for them. It's a very meaningful job to begin with, obviously, because we're, you know, kind of fulfilling the promise it's made to service members that they won't be left behind. Like that their country will continue to try and, you know, to bring them back. And I think that carries extra weight for a lot of the active duty guys, the vast majority of whom have been in combat recently, to see the other side, you know, to kind of see the dedication that the military has to them individually. I think there was some real meaning for them that way.
Well, with the camaraderie that the military instills in you right from boot camp, I was in the Navy for 4.5 years, nothing like the Army or anything like that, but still the camaraderie mm-hmm. that they instill in you, I can imagine, you know, I mean, it is very personal then for them, because it could be them on the other side of that at some point in the future, you know? I mean, they just never know. Mm-hmm. So,
right.
Okay. So how does somebody else get involved with this? Do they have to be in the Army Corps like you are, you know, you're a civilian, but you work for the Army Corps. You know, how does Joe archaeologist listening to this, who wants to go down this path, where would they have to go?
They would either have to get a contract with DPAA, work for a company that had a contract with DPAA, work for DPAA, or work for the Army Corps. to the best of my knowledge, mm-hmm. I don't, it's a very common question. Everybody who hears about this, you know, gets the importance of it and wants to go do it. Mm-hmm. But it's not necessarily easy to do. And as I mentioned on the break, there's a whole lot that goes into this. You know, you gotta get your clearances. You have to get vaccinations. I got like 20 something shots to do this. You need a military ID just to get on the base. There's all kinds of stuff that's involved in it that would make it, you know, unnecessarily onerous to get volunteers out there.
Right.
Not to mention the expense. These missions are really expensive.
Imagine.
You know, they fly us out there on our very own C-17, and then we have helicopters the whole time that are shuttling us to and from the site. Everybody's on the clock. You're paying for all the LAO workers. You're paying the government for access to the land. You're paying the landowner. I mean, these are really expensive operations. And there's not a lot of room to just kind of bring folks on.
Sounds like a typical West Coast CRM archaeology project. We like to make the East Coasters feel bad.
Yeah, well, certainly in the sense that people on the West Coast are paid better.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, we've got a few more questions, but Doug, go ahead.
Yeah, Joe, you mentioned helicopters ferrying people out to the site. So do you guys not camp next to the sites? Basically, I imagine you're at some sort of military base that then takes you out mm-hmm. each day, or do you guys just have to camp or even backpack your way into remote areas?
So we were in a guest house in a little village in Laos, and we flew to the site in helicopters. In Vietnam, they do set up base camps on site. They don't do that in Laos because of the all this is negotiated with the government, and they don't have that set up in their government negotiations with the country of Laos.
What do the locals feel about this? I'm sure if you guys are in a guest house, you're probably interacting with locals a little bit in your evenings, even though you got long days. What's the reception that you experienced?
Our interaction with the locals in town, it was pretty minimal because, mm-hmm. As I mentioned earlier, there's not much time off, and we're mostly working. And then when we're not working, we're, you know, eating dinner and going to sleep. The people who worked at the guest house where we stayed, obviously, were appreciative of the tremendous amount of business they were getting. Most of the people in town seemed, I don't know, almost indifferent to us being there. Although in the country of Laos, the hangover from the war is still very present, and it wouldn't be unexpected to have stronger reactions from people, but you don't typically get it. The workers on site were different. So, I mean, ethnically different. We're in a different elevation, different group of people. Where we were staying, with lowland Lao people in the lowland Lao village. Up in the mountains, we were with our workers were ethnically Hmong. They speak a different language than the people down low. There's not as much interaction. They're agricultural. It's like a different world on the mountain than it was down at the guest house.
You know, so when you're up on the mountain and you've got those locals, I imagine when you're working in such a jungle environment, you know, the locals always know way more than you guys know, right? So do you ever get any local informants while you were out there this last time saying, hey, you're digging here, but, you know, just over that hill, I saw a plane crash or something over that way. Did you have any of that when you were there?
Absolutely. Not as much while I was there, but on previous missions they had.
Mm-hmm. Probably good source material for future missions, huh?
Yeah, I mean, that's when they do the initial investigations, that's what they're doing. And we're encouraged on our investigations to talk with the local villagers through our interpreters to learn, you know, what we can about of the site if there's anyone who has any direct knowledge of it.
Okay.
And, you know, there was a little bit of that. Now, go ahead. We'll carry on.
No, go ahead. This is good.
I like to digress and ramble.
That's fine. Yeah, we're nearing the end of this. We've only got about 5 or 6 minutes left. So, you know, while we're talking about this, I saw on that article that there are 17 more planned month-long missions throughout Southeast Asia this year. Are you going on any more, or are you planning on going any more in the future, maybe beyond this year?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. We don't the schedule of other missions isn't out yet. The first Vietnam mission is going to head out in several months. They only run missions during the dry season. It's a wet season right now, so there's no missions going on mm-hmm. in Southeast Asia at the moment. So they'll kind of like run through our winter.
Okay.
So I don't know when, but I'm hoping to get out on at least one or two more this year.
Nice. Okay. Awesome. Steven, go ahead.
Yeah. So it seems like the data recording and field methods and everything is a lot more forensically oriented than what we traditionally do in CRM. So how do you find that this, your experience doing this has influenced the way that you do archaeology in a CRM setting in your day job?
No.
Why is that?
It's very different than, I mean, the way I look at it, when you're doing any kind of archaeology at any stage in your investigation, you're answering a question. If you're not answering a question, you're wasting your time. You know, whether that's at the very early stages where your question is, are there any potential resources that are going to be impacted by this project, right? Or is there data potential in these resources, or are these important to the tribes? And then the question of data recovery, you're answering specific questions. The questions that we're answering in Laos are fundamentally different. You know, we're looking, the question is this incident related to this particular loss? And then the second question is the individual here? So the methods are very different. The situation's very different. I get if there's anything that would influence it, it would be it's made very clear that you can do archaeology, and this is somewhat anathema to the way at least CRM archaeology is done in the States, but not necessarily academic archaeology, especially overseas. You can do archaeology, and you can do really good archaeology with a lot of your labor force not being archaeologists. We think of, you know, in the States at least, I know a number of the people on the call are not in the United States. in CRM context, we think, you know, everybody out there is an archaeologist and kind of self-identifies that way. And I think it's possible to do good work without that same kind of structure. But, I mean, other than that, I don't think it colored how I do archaeology. I certainly I'm not going to switch to a notebook without forms at home.
Nice.
I actually find myself formatting my notebook as though it were level forms and site forms anyway.
I imagine. You do what you know, right?
Right. Yeah. You do what you know and how it works.
Nice. What's in Laos in particular, since that's where your experience with this is so far, what's the local archaeological situation? Are there local, do they have a CRM type thing in Laos or local universities with archaeologists or anything like that that are interested in what you guys are doing?
That's a kind of a two-part question. The first part is I don't know. And the second part is also I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know what the state of Laotian archaeology is. I think it's probably not very well advanced. Archaeology is in a kind of a bourgeois pursuit in a way. And Laos is among the poorest countries in the world. The vast majority of the population's, not educated. A lot of people aren't literate. And it's also just the concept of doing archaeology in Laos would be very dangerous.
Wow. So we are completely out of time, but it sounds like we could really dive more into this. So maybe, Joe, once you go on another expedition over there, maybe Laos, maybe another country, we can have you back on to talk some more about your experiences there.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks a lot, Joe. And we'll see you guys next time on the CRM Archaeology Podcast. That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/CRM Arc Podcast. If you like the show and want to comment, please do. You can leave comments about this or any other episode on the website or on the iTunes page for the episode. You can also email me at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com or use the contact form on the podcast webpage. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or tweet your questions with the hashtag CRMArcPodcast or you can tag @ArcPodNet in your tweet. Please share the link to the show wherever you saw it. If you share CRM archaeology-related items on Twitter or Facebook or anywhere else for that matter, be sure to use the hashtag CRMARC so the community can see and comment. If you'd like to subscribe to this podcast, you can do so on iTunes or on Stitcher Radio. You can also type the name of the podcast into your favorite podcasting app and subscribe that way. Don't forget to go over to iTunes and leave a review of the show. It helps us get noticed so more people can find our podcast and benefit from the content. Also, send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. Also, please consider donating to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Your donations help fund our bandwidth and contribute to our editing costs. Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye.
Bye, y'all.
Bye.
This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to arcpodnet.com/members for more info.